Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Fran Lewis from Upper Westchester, and guess what, everybody? It's not snowing. It's beautiful outside, and the sun is shining. And have we got a show for you? Oh, boy. We've got the author of Providence Rag, which is a 5-star outstanding novel. I know, because it's going to get 5 stars from this reviewer next week. And it's Bruce DeSilva, who grew up in tiny Massachusetts mill town where the mill closed when he was 10. And he had an austere childhood. He loved iPods and Xboxes and all other cool stuff. And I love Xboxes, too. And I love to play with iPods. That's even better. And he's a crime fiction writer. He's won the Edgar Awards and many others. And hi, Bruce. How are you?
I'm doing just great. How are you, Fran?
Oh, just peachy. Wonderful. And would you tell everybody something about Providence Rag and how come you wrote it? And this is the third in the series?
Yes, it is.
Could you give us just a bit of a summary of the book so that everybody that's listening is going to want to buy it and read it?
Sure. Providence Rag is it's the first novel that I wrote that's based loosely on a true story. And it's a serial killer case. And the truth is that when I first started writing novels, I swore I'd never write a serial killer book, but this case has just nagged at me for a very long time. Let me tell you about a little bit about the real case that that prompted the book. It's a case of a man named Craig Price, who started killing his neighbors, women and children, in the neighborhood where he grew up in near Providence, Rhode Island. And the killing started when he was only 13 years old. And he was caught when he was 15, which makes him the youngest serial killer in American history. And that's not the interesting part. The part that I found fascinating is that when he was caught in 1989, the Rhode Island juvenile justice laws hadn't been updated in a very long time. And when they'd been written, no one had imagined a child like this. And so the law said that when he turned 21, they had to let him out and so that he could have a fresh start in life. So the state was faced with the prospect of this man who was clearly a psychopathic killer, getting out and starting in all over again, killing people. What happened, though, is that all these years later, 25 years later, Craig Price is still in jail, and he's never been allowed out. And the reason he's still inside is that the state kept, every time he got close to a release date, the state would charge him with some new offense that he supposedly committed on his inside. And I've been very skeptical about those charges. I think some of them may have been fabricated, but in the very least, he's been wildly overcharged. For example, he was given a 30-year sentence for contempt of court because he didn't want to take a psychiatric examination, a court-ordered psychiatric examination. So if the state has been playing games in order to get around the law and keep him locked up, that's morally reprehensible. It's illegal, potentially. And it's certainly dangerous in a democracy. I mean, that's not how we do things. We don't make up the law as we go along. And if they could do this to him, they could do it to anybody, right?
Yep.
On the other hand, you want to let him out? No, you can't really let him out. And so I found that dilemma, that moral dilemma, to be fascinating, because no matter which side of it you take, you find yourself condoning something morally reprehensible. And so I wrote the book because I wanted to explore the implications of that.
I would wonder what other people thought. I would definitely wonder what other people thought. It would be good, what's your opinion for my next book, for my next
edition. In real life in Rhode Island, nobody talks about this. Everybody's content to have him remain inside.
I can understand that.
It's hard to argue with that position. On the other hand, you know, there is another side to this. And so for the novel, what I was interested in was this moral dilemma. And so in the book, the murders are committed and the bad guy is caught in the first 75 pages. And the rest of the book deals with this moral dilemma. And in the novel, unlike in real life, there are people who are taking the other side of this issue, who are concerned that the truth needs to come out, that we need to tell the facts about the faking of charges to keep him inside, because it's dangerous to allow officials to do that. And so in the book, you have dueling investigations with people on each side of the issue struggling with each other, and eventually not only the main characters, but the whole state becomes embroiled in a very heated battle over where justice can possibly be found in a case like this.
Yeah, it is. It's scary, but then you don't really know unless you met the guy, and then you'd have to really be able to look deep inside of him as to whether he felt sorry for what he did. And the way he's depicted in the book, you begin to wonder if he has any kind of remorse or any heart or anything.
Well, and the character in the novel, you know, I haven't met the true Craig
Price. I don't know if you want to.
Well, I've written about him, and I've interviewed a lot of people about him, and in my view, he's a psychopath. But I can't, I'm a psychologist, and it's not something I could prove. But the character in the book is. There's no question that the character in the book is a dangerous psychopath who gets a sexual thrill out of killing people.
Yeah, that's what I got.
It's very clear cut that he's too dangerous to be let out. But on the other hand, the officials are fabricating charges to keep him in.
Well, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is, you were a journalist for 40 years, right? And
that's
a
right.
writing coach. I think a lot of authors need a writing coach to really, you know, put them straight for writing for the Associated Press. So what's the difference between you writing a novel and writing for the Associated Press, and which do you like better? Or is it just different?
Well, I mean, I did leave journalism to write fiction, so I really made a decision here that writing fiction is what I want to do now. But the truth is, first of all, I don't feel like I left journalism. I feel like it left me. Investigative journalism really had been my calling for all those years, both as a writer and an editor. But for many years now, newspapers, which is where I spent most of my career, newspapers, as you know, they've been hemorrhaging readers and revenue. And today, they've really kind of shriveled so that most of them are just a shell of the incredibly vital institutions that they used to be. And meanwhile, if you care about journalism and newspapers seem to be dying, where do you go to work? Network television news departments were never all good to begin with, and they've pretty much shriveled into irrelevance. The 24-hour cable news channels just spew loops of trivial celebrity news and are soapboxes for blowhards. And the few Internet sites that are really trying to be more than propaganda organs for the left or right don't have the money to cover the news with any kind of breadth and depth. And so I just didn't see anything on the horizon to replace news papers as honest brokers of news and information. And I can't believe that I can't really begin to describe what a bad thing that is for the American democracy. But I got tired of fighting the good fight. You know, I got tired of being part of a rear guard action. And so when the Associated Press offered an early retirement package, which is part of its own retrenchment in the face of these economic pressures, I decided it was time for me to do something new. You know, 40 years is long enough to do anything.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I wasn't in teaching that long, but not that much less. Yeah, I know.
So
and sometimes,
different.
Sometimes you need a change, and you need to do something different. And it's and you sound like you love what you're doing now.
It's a lot of fun. In some ways, it's like journalism in that you use a lot of the same muscles, a lot of the skills that you develop as a journalist, the skills of observation, noticing meaningful detail, being good at hearing how people talk so that you get the dialogue down right on the page. But after years of worrying about accuracy and fairness, I get to make stuff up now. And that's liberating. It really is kind of liberating and a lot of fun.
Well, you have the resources too, because you can ask different people. You can go to newspapers, the police, whatever. You can find out more things than a regular author can do, which is even better. So you said that your books are hard-boiled crime novels in the tradition of Raymond Chandler and Robert Parker. Why did you choose this particular genre?
Well, it's a genre that I've always loved, first of all. When I was a kid, those are the first writers that I fell in love with, Chandler and Hammett. And I've been reading them for many, many, many years. I've read thousands of them by now. I spent a lot of years reviewing them as well for the Associated Press. So eventually I reached a point that I thought maybe I knew how to write one. if you read that many of them and you've been critically writing about them in reviews, I reached the point that I thought, I think I could probably do this. So that's part of it. The other part of it, though, is that I think the best crime novels are about more than detectives looking for clues. They're about something more. In the best books, writers like George Pelicanos and Thomas Cook, Dennis Lehane, they're using the popular form of the crime novel to address important social issues, the kinds of things that keep you up at night. And they do it in a way that is never heavy-handed. The stories are suspenseful. Everything is about the plot and the action. And the theme of the book, the way it addresses these important issues, goes down so easily that you kind of almost don't notice it until you start thinking about it after you close the last page. And that's really what I strive to do with my books. I want them to work as exciting, suspenseful novels that are a blast to read, but I also want each of them to be about something that matters, that addresses a subject that I think is important to the country, but is also important to me.
Well, usually that's the type of book that I love reading, too, because if it has a message or there's an issue or there's something relevant, then it makes it easier for me to focus and spotlight what the author's trying to say, which I usually get, they tell me. So my favorite character, Liam Mulligan, I really like him, is the hero of your novels. He is not a police officer. He's an investigative reporter like you. He's more like you, right?
Yeah, there are a number of my former journalism colleagues that have convinced themselves that I've based Mulligan on them. Yeah, they're sure. They're absolutely sure. And a couple of people I used to work with at Providence Journal years ago are named Mulligan. So they're even more sure that I'm happy about them. But really, Mulligan is a lot like me. We have the same attitudes toward things. We have the same bad attitude toward authority. We both kind of have the same smart mouth. But the main difference is Mulligan is a lot taller than I am, a lot younger. Mulligan's 23 years younger than I am.
Oh, okay.
So he's a taller, younger version of me.
I had a funny feeling that he was mirrored you in some respect. You see, I caught that. Not bad. Okay, so the next question is, your books work as a Let me put my glasses on. That would help. Your books work as suspenseful entertainments, but you're clearly up to something more ambitious. Like what?
Well, you know, again, I'm trying to do the sort of thing that people like James Lee Burke and George Pelicanos do, to use the popular vehicle of the crime novel to examine social and moral issues that matter. And if you read Pelicanos, who I think is absolutely brilliant, his books work as great crime stories. And if, when you read them, that's what you're seeing. You're enjoying the story on the page. But each book, subtly, each book is a serious exploration of the urban landscape in Washington, D.C. And each of them just unflinchingly deals with volatile issues of race and ethnicity. Those things are always present in the book. He's always saying something about that. And I think that, again, that's what I'm seeking to do, too. So if you read Rogue Island, my first book, in that book, Mulligan is tracking down a serial arsonist. And so it's very much about the investigation to catch this person who's burning down the neighborhood where Mulligan grew up. But the book also is very much about the price America is paying for the decline of newspapers. You know, Mulligan is an investigative reporter, and I hope that as readers see the skill and determination with which someone like him pursues the truth, that they gain a greater appreciation for what all of us are losing as newspapers fade into history.
Well, next question. Oh, my eyes over here. Okay. Why did you choose Rhode Island and the title Providence Rag?
Well, first of all, I think settings are enormously important.
Yeah.
There are some popular crime novels that where you could take the story and set it anywhere and it wouldn't seem to matter a whole lot. I mean, so some people succeed in doing that, at least succeed commercially. But the most memorable crime novels, in my opinion, are the ones that transport you to interesting places and let you see, hear, and smell them. And if it's a place that you know well, the familiarity is welcome. So you find yourself saying, yes, I've been to that bar in Boston. You know, I've ridden on that rail line. And if it's an unfamiliar place, you find yourself being taken to some place that you've never been, and suddenly you experience it. So if you read Ken Bruin's wonderful novel set in his native Galway, Ireland, it's like you've been to Galway, even if you haven't. If you read, you know, James Lee Burke's David Robichaud novels, you have been in New Iberia, Louisiana, even if you never leave your house. You've been there. I have a friend named Thomas H. Cook, who's one of the best writers in the business. And Cook says, if you want to understand the importance of place, imagine the novel Heart of Darkness without the river. Yeah. So for me, my books are very much an evocation of life, 20th century life in the capital city of our smallest state. And I picked it for a number of reasons. One is it was a place I know well. I began my journalism career there. But I also picked it because it's different from most places where crime novels are set. Most of them are set in big anonymous cities like New York or Chicago or Miami. And there are also some wonderful rural crime novels. But Providence is, it's a city. It's so small, though, that it's almost claustrophobic. Almost everybody you see on the street knows your name. It's a very hard place to keep a secret. And yet it's big enough to be both cosmopolitan and have the usual urban problems. It's also got an incredible history of corruption and organized crime that goes all the way back to one of the first colonial governors dining with a pirate named Captain Kidd. So all of that, to me, makes it both somewhat different from the usual settings of crime fiction, and yet a really ideal place to put one. There was one reviewer that called my portrayal of Providence jaundiced but affectionate. I think that gets it exactly right. It's warts and all, but it's warts and all, but I really like the place, and the warts are one of the reasons I like it.
Well, wait till you read what I say about Providence, Rick. I'm not going to tell anybody yet.
Okay.
My review is definitely original. What can I say? So what has the early reaction been to this particular book? Because I read what you write online, because I know what's going on over there. That's how I got to see the cover, because I didn't get to see it yet. And so what has the reaction been to Providence Reg so far?
Well, so far it's been great. I mean, they've only done a few reviews, but they're all raves. It's got the starred reviews in both Publishers Weekly and book list, and a lot of people seem to be waiting for it. You know, I get a lot of emails and messages on Facebook and Twitter from people saying, when is it coming out, and when can we see you, where are you going on your book tour, and that sort of thing. So far, so good.
Are you coming up to Westchester for a book tour?
I am not. I'm not sure. Is there a great bookstore that I should be coming to in Westchester?
Yes, there's the Barnes & Noble in Yonkers. I know the manager very, very well. He probably would flip out if you walked through the door. That's if he's very nice to me.
If they want me to come, I'd be happy to accept an invitation.
I would. The next time I go there, I will have to tell Dave. His name is Dave, and they're very nice there. It's just that I've had a few book signings there myself, and I guess when it's somebody like you, you would get a better showing. I mean, I got a pretty good showing, but you would probably get the whole place would be filled, I'm sure.
Fran, you never know with these kinds of events.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I did a signing in a bookstore in Los Angeles for my second book, and two people came. And then I did a book signing in the little city of Taunton, Massachusetts, a very small place, and 65 people came, and they all bought books.
Yeah.
So
I had the one for my very first one. I had that. I had like about 60 people that came and bought my little friend. My name is Bertha. And then I went to a bigger store, and there were like 12.
Yeah, you never know.
Well, it also depends on the public relations person that's there. In one particular store, they did a good job, and in the other one, there was nobody there when I even got there. And they knew who I was, and they were excited that I was there, but, you know, it depends on the person that's there. So.
Yeah, it does depend also a lot on both how much promotion the bookstore gives the event and what the bookstore's relationship to its readers are.
Yeah, you know what the problem is?
Go on. I was going to say some of the big bookstore, big chain bookstores do a great job, but some of them don't really have much of a relationship with their readers. People just come in and out and they buy books and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the smaller stores, a lot of the smaller independent bookstores, work very, very hard to cultivate personal relationships with their customers, and those people tend to do a really fine job of bringing people into the store for events.
You're right, because most of the time if you go into Barnes & Noble or even what used to be Borders, whatever, those booksellers don't read. And I can go up to them and say, do you know who Bruce De Silva is, or do you know who Steve Barry is, and do you know who Tess is, and they look at me like, who? They don't read.
Yeah.
And that's the worst part about it. When you walk in and say, you don't know the New York Times bestsellers, they're right there on your shelf. How do you not know them? And they just look at you like, yeah, okay, we can't find. What section is he in? Children's? And that's scary. Okay.
But if you go into a store like the Mysterious Bookshop in Manhattan or Murder by the Book in Houston, the staff comes up to you. If you're a regular customer, they greet you by name. They know what you last bought and read, and they have recommendations for what you might want to read next.
Unfortunately,
a lot of those bookstores have disappeared, but the ones that are left are wonderful places to be.
Well, you know what's great about being a book reviewer, and you know it, you never have to go into a store and buy a book. It makes it so much easier. I get all the best sellers, and they're just sent to me, and sometimes I'll open my door and I go like, wait a minute, where did that come from? And it's just there. It's like, oh, my God, there are 14. But last week I got 10 one day, and I was saying, oh, my God, I hope something, it's something that I ordered, that I wrote, that I don't have to read. No, that I had to read all of them. So how does your fictional version differ from the real case? And how much research did you have to do?
As I said, the main difference between the real case and the book is that in real life, the people in Rhode Island are not talking about the ethical problem. They're looking the other way. And understandably so, because you certainly would realize why people would not want him to be let out. In the book, the ethical problem of whether it's right to fake charges to keep a man in prison is the crux of the story. And the strong disagreement among honorable people about what the right thing to do is at the heart of the book. Should the newspaper that Mulligan works for report the truth about these charges being faked? And if they do, and the guy gets out, what happens then? You know, and he starts killing people. Or should they suppress the truth in order to make sure that people stay safe? I think it's a question with no right answer, and that's why I wanted to write the book, is to deal with a really difficult moral question like that.
I wonder if there was a study guide at the end of the book, or a question, or said, what's your opinion? I wonder how many people would write into you or email you to find out, to voice their opinion as to what they thought. That would be a great debate.
You know, that would be a good idea, and I could certainly invite people to do that online. I hear a lot from readers anyway. People read the books, and, you know, because of email and Facebook and Twitter, it's very easy for people to get in touch with me. And so I get lots of, every time a book comes out, I get lots of emails and Facebook comments about the books.
I saw that.
It's great, really good to hear from readers.
That's the educator, reading specialist in me that, you know, comes up with something that you could use to extend what it is that's on the printed page. So when you write something like this, what are the challenges when you're writing something based on a true story?
Well, I think the main problem for me is trying to make sure that people realize the book is fiction, and to make it so, you know, obviously the case is based on a true story, but I take a lot of liberties. So the main character, the villain in the book, isn't Craig Price, the real villain in life.
Mm.
He's a made up villain.
Mm.
So I've never met him. But in the book, I invent an early childhood for him. I show him becoming the serial killer that he ends up being. I show you the kinds of things that are going on in his life that lead him to behave that way. I give him, when he's in prison, I give him a love of reading. I allow him to display a chilling sense of humor. I give him a prison jargon-like style of speaking, but I've never met him. I don't know anything about his childhood. I don't know how he talks. I don't know what I'm not even absolutely sure what drove him to murder. I think I know, but I don't know for sure in real life who we know. So the character isn't Craig, in the book, isn't Craig Price, and none of the other characters in the book represent real people either. But I found that readers, especially readers from Rhode Island where the books are set, tend to read my books as if each one was a Romana Clef, as if each one was a cleverly disguised true story. So people will email me and say, well, the mayor of Providence in Rhode Island, that's Buddy Cianci, right? And, you know, the attorney general in Clipwalk, well, that's really former Attorney General Arlene Violet of Rhode Island, right? And it's like, I told him, no, it's not. These are characters that are made up. And the only thing that the real mayor Buddy Cianci and the mayor, the fictional mayor in my book, have in common is they both have the same job, you know. And so now that I really am writing a book that's based on a real case, the first two were not. Now that I'm writing a book about a real case, I do worry that people are going to see this somehow as a disguised version of contemporary history, and it's not.
Most people do.
That made it kind of nerve-wracking to write this book. I'm not sure that I'll base a novel on a true story again, because I found that to be somewhat troubling to deal with.
Oh, I thought this was fantastic. But you know what? You wrote in the front of the book that it's fiction. I mean, everybody puts it in the... in the copyright part that it's a work of fiction or whatever, and people actually don't read it. It says, this is a work of fiction. All of the characters, organization, events, and portrayed in this novel are either products of the author's imagination or used fictitiously. People need to read, seriously. I mean, it says it right there, but I guess they come from our island, they want to be famous. So they want to be able to say that their little town is famous. And I grew up in the Bronx, and we were very famous. What can I say? We had David Berkowitz. What can I tell you?
Yes, you did.
Yeah, that was scary. So I've heard some fiction writers say that their characters develop wills of their own and start doing things their creators never intended to do. Iris Johansson says that her characters tell her what she wants, she should write, and how to go from there. So Eve Duncan runs her life. So does Liam run yours? Does he tell you what he, you know, how he wants to act and what's next for him?
It's worse than that, actually.
Uh-oh.
At times I feel like I'm being bullied by my own creations.
Oh, good.
The other day, for example, Mulligan started insisting that I turn the TV off right in the middle of the CBS tribute to the Beatles.
Oh, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, because he wanted me to write the opening chapter of a new book about it. And I already, Providence Rag is coming out. That's the third book. I've already finished the fourth book, which is going to come out a year from now.
Oh, boy.
But that's not enough to satisfy Mulligan. He wants me to start another book. And I told him, I talked to him, really, and I said, come on. Don't you want to hear John Legend and Alicia Keys sing Let It Be? And Mulligan's not the kind to let anything be. So he starts dictating the first paragraph of this book in my head. And there's just no arguing with him when he gets this way. So I had to set the show to record and sit down at the computer and write a first chapter. And I'll tell you, Fran, it wouldn't be so annoying if he was the only one who did this, but he's not.
And what, Mason too?
Mason and Zarelli, the bookie in the novels. And now I've got this new guy who's bothering
me. Oh, goody.
He started, he just showed up when I was finishing the last Mulligan novel. He just showed up. It's like kind of knocked on the inside of my skull and introduced himself. And he's an entirely new character. And I basically said to him, look, there's no place for you in this book. You're an interesting guy, but there's no room for you in this Mulligan novel. And that's not what he wanted. He wanted a book of his own. So now he keeps bugging me, and I may have to write a standalone about this guy.
Who is it?
The funny part of it is, this all sounds very weird and mystical to people who aren't novelists, and I get that. And before I started writing fiction, I used to laugh at novelists who talked like this, who talked about their characters seizing
control. A lot of them do, yeah.
Yeah, and I used to think it was ridiculous because, characters are puppets, and only the writer touches the keys. And it all sounded like mystical nonsense to me. I remember hearing the late, great Elmore Leonard say that he was totally in a panic because he was only halfway through writing his next novel and his main character got shot dead. And, I thought that was ridiculous. And now I know how that kind of stuff really happens. And there's nothing mystical about it. As novelists, we live with our characters. And, so when I walk my dog or I drive my car, They're always with me working on my subconscious, and sometimes they start talking to us in waking dreams. And when they do that, that's when you know it's time to write.
I just read Elmore Leonard's son's book. I read Peter Leonard's book, Eyes Closed Tight. Excellent. Really,
is
really,
it? I haven't read it. I guess I'll have to.
They sent it to me as a surprise. It was just there. I'm not going to tell you what it's about. You have to decide for yourself, but it was one of those books. I'm a speed reader, so it depends. Your book took me like zap time, less than 2 hours. His took a little bit shorter because it's it was just, you know, less pages, whatever, and just quick. And but when a book takes me more than 2 days to read it, it's no good. There's a problem. Although one book I just finished, which was excellent, Citadel by Kate Moss, it was just that it was 700 pages and I actually took my time reading it.
Yeah.
So, next question. I've got plenty more. Here we go. If you lived your whole life, you've lived your whole life in the age of television, has that influenced your writing? Well, what would you do if you, you know, if there was no television for a month? Would it make your writing easier?
I don't think so. The way I write is I have a specific goal for myself. I have to write 1,000 words a day. And if I get 1,000 words written in 2 hours, which happens sometimes, I can have the rest of the day off. But if I don't have those 2,000 words written after 8 hours, I have to keep my butt in the chair until I do, because to me, that's how you get a book finished. You set a reasonable goal for yourself, so a makeable goal, and then you stick to it. But most days, you know, I write for 4 hours, maybe 6 hours, and then I do other things, work around the house and walk my dogs and edit my wife's work. So there's usually time for me to watch television at night or to do other things, like lose to my wife in Scrabble, which happens with great frequency. I do watch a fair amount of TV, and I'm one of those people who thinks that we're in the golden age of television, and that, in fact, best television today is better than the best of what's coming out of Hollywood, and better than the best movies. I'm not saying most television isn't crap. It is. 95% of everything is crap. You know, 95% of television, of music, of books. What we all try and do is look for the parts that aren't crap. You know, we look for the good stuff. And on television, I've learned a lot about watching the best TV, a lot about character development and story structure and pacing and scene setting and dialogue from shows like Breaking Bad and Mad Men and The Sopranos and Justified and Deadwood and Masters of Sex and House of Cards and The Wire. And now this amazing show on HBO, this amazing short series, True Detective, which is just stunning both in the acting and the writing and stunning visually. And I don't just watch these things. I rewind them, and I study certain scenes to try and understand how they worked. Just like reading a good book, watching a good piece of a film or a good television show, there's something to be learned from that.
I agree with you, because most of television, unfortunately, is reality television, and after a while it gets old and gets kind of boring, and it doesn't require that you have to think, and that gets me annoyed that they feel that the American public has reduced themselves to just sitting in front of people watching them vote on whether they're the best person to sing or not. As a matter of fact, I didn't even realize the Academy Awards were on the other day, and I said I really didn't need to watch that either. It's just like, they're supposed to do a good job, and they spent millions of dollars on giving them awards. So if you could tell a new writer, what kind of advice would you give somebody that's just starting out? And I noticed that my friend Karen is in the chat room, so I'm sure she's going to have a question in a minute, because I know that. If you could tell a new writer something, what would be the most important thing that they need to know about writing a novel?
Well, if we're talking about a young person.
Yeah, novice or anybody.
Well, but there's a difference. But my advice would be different. For a young person who wants to write novels, I'm going to tell them that they should do something else first.
Mm-hmm.
That they want to attend bar or teach school or join the army or drive a cab. Because until you've lived a little, I don't care if you've got an MFA in creative writing, until you've
mm-hmm.
lived a little, you really don't have anything worthwhile to write about.
I got it.
What I tell an older person, any younger person, what I tell someone who finally has something they write about and is ready to write, is to do not let yourself be intimidated by the seemingly enormous task of writing a whole book.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it that way, my God, I've got to write, you know, 400 pages of text. It seems insurmountable. But if you write just 500 good words a day, which is the equivalent of a sixth-grade writing assignment,
mm-hmm.
you can finish the first draft of an 80,000-word crime novel in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, the key is set a reasonable goal for yourself, something makeable, and then stick to it. What you don't want to be is a dabbler or a wannabe. Real writers write. They sit down and they actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do this even if you have a very demanding full-time job by setting a small word goal for yourself. If you can't write 500 good words a day, write, you know, 1,000 good words a week. If you do that, if you write 1,000 good words a week, which, again, is very little, you can write 1,000 good words a week if you just give up, you know, watching the Letterman show at night.
Mm-hmm.
1,000 good words a week gets you an 80,000-word novel in 80 weeks, right? A year and a half. So if you've got the talent, if you've got the talent and the imagination to write, you do have the time. Even if you think you don't, you really do have the time in life to do this.
You're right, because 500 words is not. My book reviews are 1,500 or 1,200.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can write it. But someone once said to me that if you're going to write your novel or you're going to even write a set of short stories, that you should write about something that you know about before you tackle something else. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that you want to write about what you know. I think you want to write about places that you know. If a setting is as important as I think it is, I can't write a book set in Bangkok, Thailand, because I've never been there.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, my books are not only set in Rhode Island because I know the place, but my character is an investigative reporter. Partly because I used to be one.
That's something that I know,
and I can take readers into that world and make it come alive for them. Now, if you want to write about something that you don't know, a world that you don't know, you can do it, but it's harder, and it means you've got to do a lot of research.
Yeah.
You have to immerse yourself in that world. That can be a great thing to do, too, because it means – that writing the book gives you the opportunity to discover something new out there that you didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time you sit down to write the book, you do. You better. The research better have made you familiar enough with that world to write about it in a way that's credible, that readers can truly believe.
Oh, I agree, because whenever I get a book that's historical fiction or based on real life, whatever, I usually look it up. And I look up the real case. I looked up the real case in this particular one, and I looked up the real case when I did the John List murders, A Devil in a Hole by Charles Salzberg, because I wanted to get to know the real person that committed that murder and killed his whole family. So even if it's a Steve Berry novel or a John Land, I look up the research to make sure that, it's always perfect. Steve Berry's always perfect. But I like to get to know what he researched so I can understand the novel better too. So this is a loaded question. If somebody offered you $100 million on the condition that you would never write again, would you take $100 million?
You bet. I'd take the money, and I'd hate my life. I'd fake my own death and write under a pen name.
That is so cool. That is cool. Okay. So, well, there's a question that you wrote, but I was going to ask this anyway. Let's say you had the chance to set this on the big TV screen or an HBO movie or a Lifetime series. Who do you see playing Mulligan? Well, the young Mulligan. You could play the other one.
I've thought about that in a number of ways. And when I first started writing a novel, Rogue Island, I had the chance to sit down and chat with Dennis Lehane, who's an old friend.
Mm.
And one of the things said to me is, when you're writing the book, don't start thinking about who's going to play the character in the movie. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because if you start picturing your character as being some actor, it's going to really affect the way you write the character.
Mm.
You're going to start to write the character so that he is Matt Damon, you know, or that he is Bruce Willis. And you don't want to do that. You want to create this original character yourself, and then if somebody plays him, they have to become him rather than the other way around, rather than you making him into this who you think this actor is. And I think that was good advice. But by the time I finished Rogue Island, I couldn't help myself. I was picturing Mulligan as looking and sounding a lot like Dennis Leary.
The
Boston-based actor who created Rescue Me for FX television. I pictured him very much as Dennis Leary, although Leary's a little too old for the part.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah, but I pictured him kind of being like that. Leary has that both the right accent, because Rhode Islanders talks a lot like Leary, although Leary's from Boston. But Leary has that smart-ass attitude and that bad attitude toward authority that, you know, that suits Mulligan. I also think, though, that the Mulligan novels are probably better suited to television, to be the inspiration for a television drama than they are for a movie. You know, most crime movies are filled with car chases, gun battles, and things blowing up.
Yeah.
And my books aren't like that, you know. But the best television crime dramas, you know, like Justified and True Detective, place much more of a premium on character development and sense of place. So I think that might work well for TV. And the other thing I'd say about that is my agent in Hollywood has been showing the novels around. He says he had some nibbles. The nibbles are from TV people rather than movie people. But nobody's pulled the checkbook out yet.
Yeah, it's really hard. And then I know that Tess has her Rizzoli and Isles, but she did say that they have more. Once she agreed to let them, you know, use the series, they change everything. So that's what makes it difficult, because I would hate to see them change who Liam is after they, you know, put him on the wide screen. Which leads me to just
one of the things they changed with Roselli and Isles is in the book, Roselli is kind of a washed up, worn out, dumpy character.
Exactly.
And in the TV show, she's Angie Harmon.
She does not fit. I even said it to Tess when I interviewed her. She does not fit, and the girl that plays Maura Isles definitely is not the type either. It sort of blows it for the books, because her books are phenomenal. And Jane Rizzoli is definitely looks more like Tyne Daly. In Cagney and Lacey.
Right, but they wanted somebody glamorous for the television show, so.
Yeah, well, they wanted people to watch it. What can I say? So before we close, I got a few more questions, but let me just make one short announcement. Next Thursday, people, Colin Eggers at 4. The week after, Tess Garrington at 4. And the week after that, Dr. Maxine Thompson, Marcia Cook, Rita Plush, and my favorite Dolores DeLuce counterculture diva, and a surprise guest. I can't tell you who it is that's going to join these. It's Women's History Month, and we're going to talk about strong women characters in their novels and how they created them and how in history, past or present, influence their lives the most. It should just be different. And it's going to be just book discussion, or maybe we'll just call it Chat Time with Fran, which is my other show. So your wife, Patricia Smith, is one of the most honored poets, because I looked it up. I know that. And you win the Edgar Award. She wins the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize, 2 Pushcart Prizes, the Rattle Poetry Prize, and the National Poetry Series Award, and is the finalist for the National Book Award. And you get invited to speak at the Thriller Fest. She gets invited to speak at Carnegie Hall, the Sorbonne. My first panel recital was at the Carnegie Hall, so that's exciting. So what's it like to be second best? Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's right. I'm the second best writer in my family. I freely admit it. My wife is a genius.
Oh, okay. At least she knows that.
I like to joke that it's a daily humiliation, but the truth is I wouldn't be the success I am if it weren't for her. She's my first reader. She's my first reader. She's my editor. She makes suggestions that add a touch of lyricism to my writing. You know, I get to live with and have as my live-in editor one of the best writers on the planet and one of the greatest poets of the century that we're in. She's a wonderful person, and it's absolute joy for me and a privilege for me to have this astonishing woman as both a soulmate and a writing partner. And by the way, one of the things in the future is that we are starting to collaborate on a novel that we're going to write together.
I just had that on my paper. I just wrote co-author. Would you believe that is written right under that, underneath the question?
We're going to write a book together.
It's
going to have alternating narrators. So a part of the book will be written in first person in her voice, and part of it first person in mine. And it's going to have two main characters, a Chicago woman who lives in the West Side neighborhood where Patricia grew up. And it's going to be set in Chicago just before and during the 1968 riots that burned down much of the West Side neighborhood where Patricia lived as a child.
Okay, so I get a copy of the book and I get to interview both of you at the same time. No, that would really be great. I would get a kick out of that. So before we close, you got to tell everybody, why does Liam call say to Mason, "Thank you, Dad"? That is hilarious.
Thanks, Dad. Yeah.
Thanks, Dad.
Mulligan is from the very first book. Mulligan was an experienced investigative reporter working at this dime newspaper in Providence. And in the first book, this kid, Edward Anthony Mason IV, shows up straight out of Columbia Journalism School. And he's a child of privilege. He's the son of the wealthy publisher that Mulligan works for. And he expects that he's going to dabble for a bit in the newsroom as a reporter to learn the craft and then eventually become the publisher of the paper himself by birthright. And so Mulligan takes an instant dislike to him. Mm. Mulligan, who grew up in a tenement house in a working-class Providence neighborhood, sees Edward Mason as a dilettante and expresses his contempt for him by calling him "Thanks, Dad," because he figures everything he has is owed to his father. But over time, as we see Mason grow, in the first book and then the second book and certainly in the third book, Mason reveals himself to be very intelligent, very dedicated to the craft of journalism, very serious about what he's doing, and Mulligan gradually develops a grudging respect for his intelligence and his tenacity. However, Mulligan is still calling him "Thanks, Dad."
I get such a kick out of it. I love it. I love his sharp tongue. And I love the fact that he's so tenacious that he doesn't give up until he gets the job done. He doesn't back off, which is more like me, too, because I never back off. It's terrible. Okay, so what's next for you and my favorite character, Mulligan? Oh, by the way, everybody, Providence Rag and Bruce DeSilva are going to be featured in MJ4, my fourth edition, which is going to come out at the end of April, and hopefully in between there, I'm going to take your advice and write my next 500 words on my Faces Behind the Stone series, which is written from the point of view of the dead person behind the stone in short stories. And it's just something I've done, and the first three seem okay. We're going to try to write a fourth, and hopefully more people will like it. But what's next for you and for Mulligan? What did Mulligan tell you was next?
Yeah, he's running the show. Mulligan's fourth novel, tentatively titled A Scourge of Vipers, is finished. I just finished it last week.
Nice.
And it's going to be published about a year from now, next in March of 2015. And all I want to say about it right now is that in the book, Mulligan explores the world of legal and illegal sports gambling and, of course, finds plenty of trouble. When I return from my month-long book tour that starts next week, I've got to dig into the next Mulligan novel, the one that will be coming after that, and I've already written the first chapter, so it's on the way. Mulligan's going to be with us for a while.
I hope so. That is so great. And, of course, I read all of your articles, and I read everything online, and I read what other people say. And I don't normally get into discussions on Facebook. I just basically post my book reviews and my radio shows. But when I see that Bruce DeSilva says his book is coming out, and that at least you saw it, I go, like, when am I getting my copy? So you can expect that next year, too.
Well, let people know they can find me on Facebook.
That's what I want to know.
They can find me on my website, brucedesilva.com, and on my blog, brucedesilva@wordpress.com. I'm always happy to engage in conversations online with readers.
Well, I'm going to be posting Bruce's review on Tuesday on my Just Review site on WordPress. It's just for reviews, people. And on my Gabina49 site on WordPress, my sister used to call me that, and about 30 other sites. And we're going to put this one in Red Room also, because there are a lot of important people that read my reviews in Red Room and Scoop It and a whole bunch. I usually post things on about 25 or 30 sites. So you'll probably see a Tuesday on all of my author sites, which is about 25 or 30 of them. And I run my own review site, by the way, on Facebook called Reviewing Your Book. So, and there's another one called Need a Review. So if anybody out there needs a review, I've got a whole bunch of people that review besides me. Just request it. Request to join the site and request a review, and I'm sure that, people will grab it up. So I want to thank you so very much.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so very much, and I'm looking forward to reading your collaborated book with your wife. When do you think that's going to be done?
Well, it's hard to say. It has to get in line with several other projects we both have in the works. Patricia has two poetry books that are in various stages of being written, and I've got, in addition to the next Mulligan novel and the novel that standalone book that I mentioned that I'd like to write, there's also a crime fiction short story anthology that I'm hoping to edit. So there's a lot
good.
Of work ahead for both of us.
Well, if Patricia ever wants me to attempt to read any of her books and review them, just let me know. Send one. I can try. I've been pretty good with those.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so very much, and we will be back next Thursday with Caller Niggers at 4. Have a nice day, everybody, and good night.
Very cool. Thank you.